You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
Hey, everybody. How's it going? I want to tell you about our friends from Washington, Sinusoid. The Soid Boys have been sponsoring this podcast for quite some time, and I want to just give a big public thank you to Andy and Anthony and Kevin and the rest of the crew up there. They're doing great things, and they're really putting out a great product. And if you haven't had a chance to scope out any of their wares yet, might I suggest something that we all need? Speaker cable. Everybody needs a speaker cable. So check out the Sasquatch. It's a huge, beefy, beast-like speaker cable, and one of the cool things is, like, it's so very obviously not an instrument cable. You're not going to have any mistakes, most likely, unless somebody's had a few too many cold ones. You're not going to have any mistakes with somebody plugging in an instrument cable from your amp to your speaker cab, which, as a lot of you probably know, is bad. It's bad. Don't do it. Use a speaker cable. So the Sasquatch will ensure that that is very unlikely to happen because it's huge. It's like that. There's no instrument cables that are made that way. And you pick it up, you really feel like you're holding a substantial piece of equipment because you are. They're all made up in Washington, one at a time, to order, and they have a 100-year warranty. So unless you're planning on living way into some sort of, you know, mutated state where you're beyond human, then I think you're going to be good. Should be the last cable you ever need. So hit up the Soid Boys, and as the kids say, treat yourself. We are also brought to you by, actually, today's guest. Today's guest is Sean Arbo from Gun Street Wiring Shop. He decided to make the trek up to Portland, and, you know, I won't do too much, but they did technically sponsor this episode. So make sure you check out Gun Street Wiring Shop. They're the place to go for all of your wiring harness needs, and Sean will work hard to ensure you get exactly what you want, functioning exactly the way you need it. So hit up gunstreetwiringshop.com and check their wares, and he's really open. If there's anything that you think you need, he can do it for you. He's also got his standard kits that they've perfected over the years. And the install is really easy. If it's easy for me, I guarantee it's going to be easy for you. So hit up gunstreetwiringshop.com. And without further ado, let's talk to Sean. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the ToneMob.com podcast, the show about guitar tone and the people behind it. I'm your host, Blake Weiland, and with me today, I have Sean Arbo of Gun Street Wiring Shop, actually live in the Shred Shed this time. We're not remoting it. We're not phoning this one in, as they call it.
Probably better that way.
So, I don't know. How's your drive? How's the commute into work today?
It's pretty good. I mean, I make the drive a lot with my wife being here, or from here, being from Gresham. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, just like another drive over the hill. This time I'm not seeing grandma though.
and it comes to find out that just by chance your aunt lives,
like, yeah, exactly,
right in my neighborhood, basically
the next block over.
Small world.
It's really small.
That's so crazy.
How many times have I driven by here accidentally?
Yeah, now that's even funnier. Like, yeah, I was probably in here playing fuzz pedals and
exactly.
You're out driving around the neighborhood.
It's like, by, wait, what's that sound?
I hear it. I hear square waves. I hear them somewhere. But you know, a lot of the listeners know you've been sponsoring the podcast for a while, and they know, you know, I've talked about your products and what you do. But I think what might be more important is to get your backstory. You know, people don't just wake up one day and start, you know, making guitar parts for a living. So how did that come to be? You know, start from way back. When did you first start playing and all that?
Well, I guess for the most part, my family is very artistic and very all about doing things your own way. So that's probably one of the main thing that caused me to be partially where I'm here. And then, you know, the second probably biggest focus and what really got me stuck on playing guitar is I kind of grew up with a mystery illness and I had a lot of free time, which guitar ended up, you know, making that time go by so much quicker. My start with guitar was when I was like 13 or 14. I have an older brother who tried to play guitar, and my parents bought him everyone's favorite entry level guitar, which is a Slammer Hammer.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. It actually wasn't that bad of a guitar.
No, they're not.
Especially for its price. But my brother really never, it never stuck with my brother. So it ended up just kind of hanging out in his room for most of his life. And then, so when my brother would be at school, I would go and sneak into his room and then, you know, turn the amp, the tiny little Dean amp up as loud as I can go. And I would play and I'd learn. I caught on really quickly and I really loved it. It was also like that kind of time in your life where you really love music and you really understand the importance of what music can do. And especially for my circumstances of where I was at that time, it was like that one special thing. How that kind of changed into later. I guess it's interesting as more and more people are associating me with guitar electronics and building guitar electronics. Mm-hmm. I would classify myself more of a guitar builder or more or less a modder. And that really kind of ties into kind of my experience with guitar. So my brother found out that I was stealing his guitar and playing. He came home from school when he really shouldn't have. And exactly. I got in trouble that night. He didn't. So then my parents ended up buying me my very first guitar, which was a First Act, like the cheapest First Act you can get. Mm-hmm. It was a Telecaster shape. The most brutal guitar ever, in the sense of it's truly unplayable. No. I would play it and then you'd end up with like just cuts on your hands from just how sharp those frets were. Mm-hmm. So you know, that was kind of also the start of like, okay, I'm gonna try to make this a little bit better, just at least playable, because I didn't know if I could get another guitar. And then eventually my parents kind of saw that, okay, that's really dangerous that he's playing that. So they bought me a Ibanez Geo, which I'm not saying it's a bad guitar, but it wasn't a guitar that fit me. And quickly I was like, okay, I really don't like that guitar. And I, at that time, I couldn't really define why I didn't like it. Mm-hmm. And then my parents ended up buying me an Epiphone Les Paul Standard Type. It was technically a classic. So that's like the quilted top one.
Right.
And I loved the shape of that. I loved the look on that, but I couldn't play it because what I ended later up finding out through my uncle, who's also like a super guitar geek, is it's a thin neck. And I'm a tall guy, but back then I still wasn't really that tall, but my hands were gigantic. Mm-hmm. So I really needed that like super thick 50s, like basal bat and or 59 neck.
Mm-hmm.
But when you try to explain that to my parents, it was a little challenging to be like, well, it's just because it's the neck, which to them, they're not very, they like music, but they aren't musicians. So they don't really, they didn't grasp it at the time. And plus, probably looking back as an adult, I'm like, they're probably still paying off the last guitar they bought for me.
Right.
Yeah. So at that point, you know, I wasn't going to get any new guitars. And so my personality type is, you know, I roll with the punches and that was really when I started getting into what really makes a guitar a fun, playable guitar and getting into setting up the guitar properly, and, you know, how the action affects all the stuff. So I really got into modding in that sense. I wouldn't say modding sound-wise. That was kind of later on, but I got into kind of making a more playable guitar, and I maxed those guitars out to the best of my ability with how limited my funds are. And then somehow, it's really not that surprising if you know me, I got into building guitars, and I begged and begged and begged my parents to buy me like a really nice guitar. One, it was unrealistic because my parents they're not the richest, but they're not like broke, so they couldn't really afford it. Mm-hmm. But they really did try to help. So they couldn't afford the guitar I want. So my buddy Curry, his dad built cabinets. So I had access to a shop, and then somehow I was like, okay, you know, I think I can build it. Mm-hmm. And I ended up, you know, planning out every single detail. And I originally wanted to build a Les Paul Standard, which it's funny nowadays thinking about it, because the complexity of a Les Paul Standard to build itself is pretty advanced.
I was going
to
say.
Yeah. And for your first guitar, I don't think it's going to turn out pretty well. It might. I don't know. But it didn't. And so I wanted a Les Paul, because at the time that was my favorite shape. And to this day, it's probably my top two. SG, mm-hmm. It's number one. And so I was like going through it, and I tend to be the person who, I think my favorite thing to do about when building something or just even doing anything is the physical planning side of it. Like I could spend the most of my time planning it to a weird detail that I can never actually achieve, but I know what I want to do.
Right.
So I ended up doing that, and I discovered cost-wise, the Les Paul Standard wasn't going to catch. It ended up being like, you know, $2,400 the way I wanted to do it, mm-hmm. which is no way. I figured out that my parents were more likely to let me build a guitar if I did it in small increments. So it's like I can buy a fretboard one week, or wood for a neck another week. So mm-hmm. I ended up going through it, and I factored in that the Les Paul Junior was mm-hmm. the shape I wanted and the build I wanted. And it ended up costing my parents probably like $30 a week or maybe month.
It's not so too bad.
No, yeah. Not too bad at all. And knowing myself, I knew it was going to take me forever to do, just because it's like, I've never done this. So I did that. And that was my first experience with building. And I built that guitar over the next year and a half, maybe a little bit longer, because it ended up being like I had a set budget that I could do. And then there's something like when you plan stuff, you can't really plan it perfectly. So then there's like the specialized tools that like, oh, this month means mm-hmm. I got to go buy a certain kind of file or a certain bit. So it took me a little bit longer. But right when I was about to finish, the only thing I had left to do was to basically set up the action. My parents got a little bit of extra money. And at this time, to give more context, because I kind of grew up sick with this mystery illness, I missed out on a lot of school. And at this time I was 16 or 17.
Okay.
And I had been out of school for about 2 years, and that, which is big,
especially like, during that time of your life.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There's a reason. I apologize if I meet people in person and I'm little kind of out there. It's because I'd spent a lot of time by myself. But my parents wanted to use that little extra money they got to kind of get me to go. At the time, they said it just to go back to school. But then I was telling them the story that about how like that's one of that moments for that kind of changed my path for life. And they said it wasn't just going back to school, but it was at that point, it was, again, we were talking about a formative life, is I had my set friends who were like, they're my friends for life. And I was just hanging out with one this past weekend. Mm-hmm. And they would hang out with me periodically. And they also played music, so we'd all have a jam band. But I would never leave the house. And what they wanted to do with this guitar was get me to go back to school and to graduate, and then also to kind of like push me out of my comfort zone, mm-hmm. and get me to go over to their houses to play music. I don't know if it's because they're, you know, they might not have liked our music at that time. It's a little loud and against my dad's James Taylor-ness.
Right.
But it was that kind of, it was a really awesome thing. And we ended up finding a 2005 SG Faded that was, one, a phenomenal guitar. I got really lucky with that guitar, and two, was in my price range. But to kind of segue it back into guitar building, I got the Gibson, and it played super, super nice, and it felt so amazing, and I really liked it. And I basically took all the measurements for string height, the bridge height, and everything, and I replicated it on that Les Paul Junior.
Okay, got
so
it.
So it played really, really nice. Mm-hmm. And most people, when you were to say, oh, that guitar was built by a 15 or however old I was, they would be like, oh, that's funny, but it was true.
Mm-hmm.
But this was probably, because I got it right around end of school year, what would be people's school year, and right around my birthday. But every summer, my uncle came from town. He's from Martinez, California. Shout out to Martinez fans, all two of you.
Yeah.
But he came up, and he was one of those people who were really like, who helped me kind of grow as a guitar lover and explained to me a lot of times like why certain body shapes are the way they are. And he was someone I really looked up to. And so he comes up, brings up his custom Gibson custom shop, Les Paul. That was like, it was so fancy. I don't even know if they did this or if this was like a custom made thing, but when you open the case, mm-hmm. it had a light that went on the guitar.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never seen it since, or I don't know if it, he's also like slightly like a tinkerer himself. So he could have probably done it himself.
Right.
But my parents, trying to kind of help me out and get me to, it sounds really weird and really bad, but like get me out of the bed. Because a lot of times the way my sickness was is I would be fine for a couple hours and then I'd be really sick for another 3 hours and then I'd be fine. So a lot of times I would just end up staying in my bed and hiding behind books.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents let me control the entire garage. So they never parked their cars in the garage, and they let me and my friends bring all their, you know, their drums, their bass, like a whole setup so you can do that. And we even had like a little recording studio. It was fun. But my uncle goes into the garage and lets his, you know, super high end guitar out on the stand. And the entire time he doesn't touch it. The entire week, he only plays my Les Paul Junior. And like the way the garage was set up is you could easily sneak in there without people knowing.
Right.
So, okay. So my uncle's like has the amp at like completely like at 10, like my neighbors probably hated us that week.
Mm-hmm.
And he's playing my Les Paul Junior and he's really getting into it. And it's like probably, you probably do this all the time. I do this where when you play guitar and you know, you screw around with the controls, but then you like stop there and you look at it and he would look at the action. He'd look at the neck. He'd look at all these kind of parts of it. And he had this like big grin on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like that first experience where something I can make has such a distinct kind of impact on someone and, mm-hmm. and can create such an awesome feeling in someone. And that was probably one, I was probably always going to have my own business. I come from a family who's like, that's what you do. You know, you always want to be, business is like the best part of life, and it's a really fun experience to have your own. But I never had a definition of what I wanted to do, and guitars was going to be that one thing.
That was a clicking moment.
That
for
was
you.
That clicking moment, and yeah. That was like I technically wanted to be a guitar builder, and then wiring harnesses came in later, and came in after kind of interacting with the community, and kind of came out of, well, one Gun Street was founded, I should say Gun Street Wiring Shop, Gun Street. When I started Gun Street in 2015, it was technically Gun Street Guitar Emporium, because
mm-hmm.
I wanted to sell vintage guitars and have my own little aspect of that. But the wiring harness was like the small side. I've always built wiring harnesses for like kind of extra money, but I did it in a way that people really took on to it, and it kind of turned into its own unique thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now it is what it is, and so far people are really liking it, and it's really fun to do, and it's really fun to interact with people because you always have your own idea of like what sounds cool.
Right.
And then you interact with people and you're like, no, this is what sounds cool.
Yeah. Everyone's got their different ideas. So the wiring harnesses though. So like you started out, you were going to sell some vintage guitars that mm-hmm. kind of became the thing. You know, when did, you know, what was your first wiring harness? That's still kind of a, like most guitar builders don't, they might wire them up themselves, but they don't sell the harnesses.
No.
So like, how did that happen?
So for most part, I spent a lot of my time on the Les Paul Forum on the Luther's Corner, and a lot of times you would interact and you'd see people build their own guitars and everything. And I always wanted to try that, so I started building my own guitars. And at start, I kind of understood how it worked, and I could copy a diagram very, very well. But I've always been someone who's kind of very cautious about anything I do. And so I was like, okay, I'll just buy one. Because there is, at this time, you can find them on eBay. Mm-hmm. So I bought it from some random guy. And a lot of times, here's a kind of a inside thing of the wiring economy, if you want to get into it, is you have a wide spectrum of people who produce wiring harnesses. You have your kind of, on one side, your people who just flat out copying diagrams and selling them as is, but have no grasp of why it actually works. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side, you have the people who are really passionate about it and can tell you every single detail. But the guy I bought from on eBay, I had a kind of just a generalized question on how something worked. And luckily he was really cool about it. He was kind of like, well, I really don't know how to fix it or how it really works. I just flat out, he's like the person who I ended up kind of later being with. Just, he did it for extra cash to pay for his other hobby. Mm-hmm. But he's, you know, he flat out was like, I don't know. And so any kind of question I had for that person, he just couldn't answer it. So that was kind of the start of like, okay, if you're selling this, you really should know what you're doing. And then I ended up, again, trying it else, still kind of got that on eBay. I ended up going through a guy on the Les Paul Forum, and he was kind of like well-known in the community. And I, at that point, I could wire my own. And I was really good at wiring the set kind of simple, like 50s or modern or the volume bleed kind of style. That's easy. But then when it got to something like a really complex, I ended up buying, it was the Jimmy Page harness, which even nowadays, it's a pain. It is a complex harness, and it is. I get where the story, as a business owner, I get where it can lead to where this is headed. Okay. But so I had issues with that harness, and then I contacted him, and it's been so long that I can't remember if like maybe I worded it wrong or maybe it came off as me attacking. But he kind of flat out was like, you know, I hate dealing with noobs. Like this is, you shouldn't be doing this if you don't know what you're doing. And it kind of like turned into this, like really, I'm somewhat sensitive when it comes to that kind of stuff. It's like, one, I'm really trying to work. I'm sincerely trying to improve myself and be better. But then you have someone who kind of just belittles it and makes you feel like, well, how, it wasn't a very fun experience on both parties. I don't condone
this
that.
This was the guy from the forum.
Yeah, right? This was the guy in the forum. And this right. was the guy who in the forum himself was like known for being like this prodigy of wiring. Mm-hmm. And it was
sort
like
of a
that,
guru type.
Guru, yeah. Yeah. And so it's like that guru just completely insults you and says and tells you that you shouldn't be doing this. And that was kind of, again, that one where it's like, now after that guy, I'm gonna learn every single part I can. Mm-hmm. Like I wanna know why that, and I ended up like the troubleshooting, I figured it out and what it was, and it was an accident. And it was one of those ones where it's like, it's a really complex harness, and it's really easy to screw up. Mm-hmm. Like it's really, and coming from it from a business side and doing this full time, like there's stuff that happens, you know, and this guy was actually doing it for part time. Like he had his own job, and on free time he would still do it. Mm-hmm. And so it, like there's so many variables that it's like, I don't blame him for it breaking because it's, or not breaking, but not working because it's really easy to screw up. The only thing I have like negative context towards is just
the conversation.
Yeah. Don't be nice to everyone. Mm-hmm. And I guess, and that also is kind of tied into Gun Street now is more of, I really want to help people. I want to, if you're my 15-year-old self, I want to help you out as much as I can. And that's also why like I go above and beyond when instructions, like I have my diagram and there's that, and it shows you how to install the pickups. But I also want to do, you know, I also have my online instructions that show you step by step. Mm-hmm. And then eventually on some of these things, we already have like a troubleshooting. So it's like, I really want to help out as much as I can out of that kind of, that experience of dealing with him. And then another thing that kind of led into Gun Street, or at least the way I wire and I sell wiring products, is in the forum. It was right in the beginning of like when people were going crazy over matched pots and paper and oil capacitors,
mm-hmm.
and how those were absolutely phenomenal. And I saved up a ton of money and bought a kit from a well-known person, and I installed it. And it was like that biggest like want moment.
Oh no.
No, you know what I mean? Like, and then I was like, okay, well, is it just like my guitar or anything? And then it kind of got into this point where, and Cole from the Gear Slum mm-hmm. recently made a comment about like how there's a side of the wiring market that really charge you for slightly mojo. And I hated that because I had that feeling. And I got to the point where it's like, when I build products, I really try to be as realistic as I can about one telling you. I'm not going to claim that I might put scent in the box. That's still being debated on the forums. I'm not going to confirm nor deny that. But I really want to give you the most unbiased opinion on that. And before, you know, I should probably do a disclaimer. The views and opinions are my own and not Gun Street's. But like, there's nothing wrong with match pots. And in certain situations, match pots are a good thing to do. And then especially, again, paper and oil capacitors, there's nothing wrong with them. And they sound phenomenal when you get a really nice paper and oil capacitor. But what I was kind of referring to is, at least in the Les Paul forum, there was the selling of like, the paper and oil is what caused the sound,
right?
Yeah, and
like the construction of it is
construction what is what it is, the mojo, mm-hmm. and it's not necessarily accurate per se. What really, and hopefully people are, you know, all caps are coming on,
they're thinking about it
exactly.
Yeah.
He's wrong. What makes a really nice quality capacitor is how accurate it reads. It's like you can have a cap that says it's supposed to be like a Les Paul when it would be like a 0.022, mm-hmm. but it actually might measure something like a 0.07 or even like a 0.47. It's not necessarily what makes a high quality part. A high quality is the tolerance and how that, and a lot of times people misunderstand that what makes the sound so much better is the physical, is not the mojo, but the actual construction.
Yeah,
and that even goes down to I mean, there's a lot of it, like the verse American pots versus metric pots, and there is some theory behind it. There is a little bit of tribalism, but my goal is I try to stay out of it, mm-hmm. even though it's really hard to not be like no, please don't attack this. The reason is that so my approach with Gun Street was kind of being really realistic. I offer a really wide spectrum of things because I want to deal with everyone in the community, not the select few. Mm-hmm. I want to sell to my 15-year-old self, or I want to sell to that person who just is starting to get in. I guess it also kind of ties back to is in my head, guitar has kind of really saved my life in per se.
Right.
I was in being sick probably the first 23 years of my life, it kind of limits your outlook on the rest of life.
Mm-hmm.
And guitar was one thing that was like, gave me hope. And it was also like that, like the social interaction of being in the community was like the best part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So my goal is kind of like, any way I can help other people out in no matter your skill level, is the best part of building products. But kind of long segue back to what you're referring to, so when I started out Gun Street selling guitars, I've always had that premise of building those harnesses. And that's when I build a harness, that's where I come from. But it really took off. Like people really like that. People like that, you know, it's very user-friendly. It's people like that I'm not like, upping my price because of being, you know, I'm not putting that in. So it started out with me doing partial guitars, partial wiring harnesses, and then for only until recently, I was working full time at a different job, and Gun Street was kind of like my
passion project.
My passion. Like, yeah. To this day, gun tree is probably solely passion. But as it kind of, it turned out is I no longer could search for vintage guitars to sell because most of my free time was going into building the wiring harnesses.
Gotcha. Because the demand those went up.
Yeah, exactly. And then it ended up going to the demand was so big that I had to cut my hours at my work. Mm-hmm. And then the demand got to the point where it's like, okay, I only can focus on wiring harnesses. Mm-hmm. I have my business model for my vintage guitar that I'm going to save for later.
Right.
And you'll have another one, different Tone Mob episode.
There we go.
Perfect. But for the most part, Gun Street is going to be just, you know, the Gun Street wiring shop and the whole kind of morality that comes with that.
Hi, I'm Vincent, and I'm here to talk about the Marist Mercury X. My dad's always going on and on about how cool Marist is. He really went off on one about the Mercury X the other day. He said something about a 4,800 hertz sample rate. And 99 preset locations and 33 banks? And something along the lines of, the most advanced reverb pedal ever devised by man? That's all true, but I only care about one thing. This pedal sounds sick! So make sure you check out the Mercury X and all the other fine products at Marist.us, as well as fine retailers worldwide. All right, Dad, now can I have my pocky?
How exactly do artists get their music on Spotify, Apple Music, Deezer, Tidal, all these services? How in the world do you get your music there? Well, in the past, you had to use something called a record label. But these days, you can use DistroKid. DistroKid is the absolute easiest way to get your music up on streaming services, and it's the most affordable way to do so. Not only do plans start at $22.99 for the entire year, that's less than $2 a month, DistroKid also does not take a cut of your streaming revenue, unlike some other services out there. Even better if you sign up by going to tonemob.com/distrokid. That's tonemob.com/distrokid. One more time, that's tonemob.com/distrokid. You'll get 30% off. That's right, 30% off. They're already extremely reasonable prices. So go to tonemob.com/distrokid and get your music out there.
So you started, like you said, you were on the Les Paul forum, mm-hmm. and you are a big Gibson guy.
Big Gibson. Gibson for life.
For life.
Whoa. For life. No, that's a lie. I like Fenders now.
just like as of last week?
As of about 2 months ago.
Yeah, I really like Fenders.
I finally got my first Telecaster. That was a experience. And then a Jaguar.
Mm-hmm.
Also experience.
And is that I'm assuming that's what made you start making harnesses for those as well.
Kind of. It's more of, I don't like making things based off of just like off of diagrams. Like I like to like know what fits. So I ended up like people were requesting Telecaster harnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to go buy. I bought two Squire Telecasters identical. And I used one for really a teardown to kind of get most of the measurements. And I did another one for instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And those were sweet guitars. They have like, doesn't matter what the price range was, they sounded so fun to play.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, those also have massive following. And then same with the Jaguar. I originally actually was gonna get the Jaguar to start doing harnesses, but that ended up being not as much requested as Jazzmasters, but they're relatively similar. And I ended up getting a Jazzmaster pickguard to do that.
Gotcha.
But it was main reason was people are asking for it.
Yeah.
And I really try to help. If people are asking for something, I sincerely listen to my customers and I sincerely want to help out as much as I can.
Mm-hmm. Give the people what they want.
Exactly.
Right. Good times. So what is interesting, maybe we need to talk about some of your musical influences, because sometimes since we've already talked off microphone a lot, uh-huh. Most of the people that I remember us talking about, I don't picture them as Gibson guys, really.
No, you
and
know.
So, like, maybe talk about some of your musical influences and because, like,
you don't just fall in love with the guitar generally. You fall in love with the music and then the guitar.
I guess that's the case. But I also, it could be the fact that my very first legit guitar was that SG. Mm-hmm. And then ever since then. But I mean, you are kind of true. Most of, like, Tom Waits is a huge, huge love of mine. And he plays a bunch of guitars, but yeah, one of his go-to is his Dan Electrico. Mm-hmm. And that is his, and has that unique sound. And then I'll give you another experience that maybe why. The very first quote-unquote rock band I got onto, mm-hmm, was The Doors.
Okay.
And Robbie Krieger played a 61, if I believe. It was a 61 style SG, or technically Les Paul. I may be wrong. It's been too many years. So that was another one where it's like, I love that shape. But for the most part, you were kind of right. It's most of my influences, Violent Femmes. I was a big Violent Femmes fan growing up. All about the angst. Gordon Gano played a Thinline Telecaster. Who else? I mean, again, you are. I never really thought about that. Most of my influences never did play the guitars I ended up playing.
No, yeah, it's the Les Pauls and the SGs and stuff. They're very much associated with classic rock and blues to some degree. Not so much. Seems like you have a lot more sort of alternative type leanings. Yeah. You know, we talked about Tom Waits. We were talking about Modest Mouse earlier. Yeah. You know, and what did you say? It was my cousin.
My cousin played in, I can't remember what his band's now, but the band changed into the Dave Depper experience. The guy's still around. He recently did a re-recording of Paul McCartney's Ram.
Okay.
And so he was a big band, but he ended up touring with Modest Mouse before they were getting big, but they weren't like over the top. I probably say most of my musical experience in my love, and especially for proto-punk, and I should just say punk in general, comes from my cousin Max, and him. My dad won an iPod, first generation iPod, and we had no music. And my parents' music is either the Beatles or my dad loves James Taylor. Like, I mean, the most kind of weird, not consistent musical influences at all. And so we ended up giving to my cousin Max, and he filled it up with this just eclectic music. And I guess that's where, although I will say, a very punk-esque guitar is a Les Paul Jr.
Oh, well, that's for sure.
I will give you that one.
Yes.
I think, now kind of processing it, I think most of my love for Gibson comes from guitar building. Because in a sense, Gibson's, at least Les Paul's, were beautiful, beautifully designed guitars and that really beautiful, thick maple top.
Mm-hmm.
But also on the same side, Fenders were... Leo Fender and the way he manufactured guitars was just like, I mean, that's the way amount of energy engineering that came in, it was just brilliant. So I also have that aspect, but now I question everything.
That's what I do.
Crisis going on right now.
I make people question themselves and everything they thought they knew.
Exactly.
No, it's just interesting to hear, because you know, sometimes I've found that these things don't make a lot of sense.
No.
Like, I mean, I liked Gibson, you know, from day one, because my dad said that he liked Gibson, but he doesn't really play electric guitar very often. He plays acoustic primarily. So why did I fall in love with the Les Paul so hard? I don't really know. I mean, yeah, when I was, you know, young, a lot of the metalcore bands that I liked were playing Les Pauls and Les Paul Customs, and a lot of the punk bands I liked were playing Les Paul Juniors, but I don't know. It didn't really make a lot of sense, because I just decided one day that I liked Les Pauls, and then when I got one, I was like, well, look at me. I'm a Gibson guy.
Exactly. Like,
that's just what I am. But, I mean, I loved country music and, you know, loved Waylon Jennings growing up. Waylon Jennings is definitely my dad's favorite artist, and like that, he plays a Telecaster.
Yeah.
But my dad said he was a Gibson man, so yeah. I thought, well, I must be a Gibson man too. You know, that just makes sense.
It's an inherited thing.
It is. It must be. But as I've gotten older and like played more and more electric guitars, it's like it didn't take me very long to figure out that I just like electric guitars.
I think that's the key. I like electric guitars, and I even like individual guitars. Like we were talking about this earlier. It's like there's certain guitars that like I think we were talking about this. I talk about this a lot.
We've been talking about a lot of things.
Exactly.
So.
And even if you get into, like, prime example is my 2005 SG Faded. It's a cheap guitar, so there's a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten the opportunity to play a lot of them. And there's something about mine that is so much better. Like the way it plays, the way it sounds has now changed to me being me, and it's been redone through every screw. But the way it plays is relatively the same. And I think that's the biggest thing about guitars itself is it really it's defined by the individual guitar, not necessarily by the shape.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a while to learn or to love. You love the general shape, but there's that one guitar that really makes or breaks it.
Yeah, and it's weird too, because sometimes you have an idea of what you think you want, and then my Tele, I always thought when I get a Telecaster, I'm gonna get a Telecaster. It's gonna have a maple neck. It's gonna be the standard traditional Telecaster. And the more I played those, and I do like them, the more I played them, it's like, no, I'm really stuck on, like, rosewood necks, or fretboards, rather. Like,
two humbuckers.
That's pretty much all I have, except for the millimetric, which is walnut and feels very similar. Like, everything's rosewood. And I'm stuck on that, because I played lots of Teles and liked lots of them, but I like my Tele Custom the best. And part of it has to do with, like, it's rosewood, and then it has a humbucker in the neck. So it's I don't know. It's a weird thing what we grow attached to, because exactly. I thought I had a pretty good variety, but it was like a few months ago I was looking like, nope, all dark necks around here.
Nope. I will say, so my wife gives me crap all the time because I will buy guitars, whether I'll buy guitars for myself or buy guitars for Gun Street to use for either reference or instructions. But I tend to buy, I think I have four Les Paul shaped guitars,
mm-hmm.
Two Telecasters. I tend to buy things in threes.
Okay.
And they are relatively, it's like they are different. We'll say that, but they're always the same. And it's probably kind of what you say is, mm-hmm. no matter how much you try to go against the grain, it ends up just going to what you like. And I guess I think that's the biggest thing about guitar and anything you do in guitars. Do you like it? And if you like it, then what's wrong with what you choose?
I mean, there isn't anything. I mean, no. I'll make fun of people who use the Helix all day long, but I'm not serious about it.
No.
Like, it works and it sounds good and it works for you. That means that is the right answer. Some people like want to like make sure that they have the right thing. I'm like, well, do you like how it sounds? Does it play like you want? Does it do the thing you're trying to do? If the answer is yes to all those, then that's the right one. And it doesn't matter if it costs $20 or if it costs $2,000. If it is something that works for you, it works for you. And what I say about it doesn't really matter.
No, exactly. And that also comes down to a lot of times with guitar wiring too, is a lot of people will tell me, it's like, oh, well, I'm only supposed to do this. So it's like, no. You can do whatever you want. The guidelines say you should do, give you a reference of something like is 500K pots versus 200K pots.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, okay, well, 500K you're supposed to use for humbuckers, 200K you're supposed to use for single coils. I mean, you could use either or. You could even use one meg pots. It really comes down to defining of how do you define your sound? Mm-hmm. What is your thing? And do you like it? That's the key, is do you like it? And if you like it, then why not?
Right. Well, and it's hard. It's really funny, especially with the single coil thing. I've heard that. Yeah, 200K with single coils. I'm like, well, P90 is a single coil.
Yeah.
But it sounds different than my Tele single coil or, you know, my Supro inspired ones in the Roni. It's like, those are all single coils.
Yeah. And that's a 500K in the volume. Mm-hmm. Pa is a 500K and then a 200K in the tone.
Right.
So that's also like, that goes against the grain.
Mm hmm. It's like, what is the right answer? The right answer is, does it sound good?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you like it?
Mm-hmm.
Then good.
Yeah. I mean, there's something to be said for, like, if you're trying to, you know, keep a vintage guitar as original
true.
As possible.
Very true.
That's a little different, though.
If you're trying to keep it vintage, it's like, be very cautious about what you do.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just... I have a hard time... I like buying vintage guitars,
mm-hmm.
and my favorite is Fender Broncos. Well, Fender Broncos are still kind of like the underdogs, and you can still get them cheap, but the parts are worth more than the guitar itself.
So really?
Yeah. So I'm like that person who like, I want to save every single one. So I, at one point I had like 4 or 5 mm-hmm. and I looked like a madman, just hoarding them all. I'm not getting them out. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, like, especially the vintage, it's like, respect that vintage instrument. Like that is something that's made it this long. Let's keep it as close as we can to keep it going, so someone else can have another experience with it.
That's one thing that I found kind of amazing. This is related, I promise, even though it sounds a little bit weird. I remember reading a thing one time that said like Taylor Guitars was producing 600 guitars a day. And I'm like thinking to myself, that's a lot of guitars. And guitars, as long as they're like even slightly properly maintained, they'll last more than one lifetime.
Yeah.
Like I've always thought that's kind of like, that's a lot of guitars that was like, where I've still not discovered the answer to it, but like, where are they going?
Yeah.
Where are they? Like 600 guitars a day is a lot. And that's just one company.
We
got Fender, Gibson, PRS, plus all the hundreds of smaller builders. It's like, and then there's those couple Korean companies that produce a ton of guitars for
everyone.
Like, yeah, different designers basically. Which I think that's kind of cool because it lets people who wouldn't not be able to have a company sometimes. And most of the guitars I played out of that, I wish I could remember the factory name.
I think Chapman Guitars uses that same pack. It's like
Chapman, Duesenberg, Reverend, like a bunch of guys.
I know. Yeah. It's this, there's in Korea, there's two,
but, I can't remember. But they're like generally really good.
No, absolutely. And that's another thing is especially in nowadays market. So Gun Street will make guitar builds, like we call them shop builds, and it's just where we get to have a little bit of fun and mod guitars in my own kind of like what I would do in real life, but uh-huh. I get to do it through Gun Street,
right?
And we picked up a $99 Squire, and to compare that $99 Squire to my $99 first act 20 years ago,
oh right,
or set amount of years ago, yeah, it's yeah. like night and day, and it's a legit nice guitar, and it's a good start. And like, I'm slightly jealous that I didn't get to start out on that. And maybe it would have been in the situation it was.
Well, yeah, you probably wouldn't have looked to improve it.
Yeah, exactly. That's fine. True.
But no, I've talked about that a lot. Like the level of quality at the top end has gone up some,
mm-hmm.
but the level of quality on the low and mid-level instruments now compared to like 10, 15 years ago is crazy. Like Squires across the board. Now, if you go pick up a Squire, it's gonna play pretty good, probably. And if not, it's a couple tweaks away.
Like, exactly.
It's very unlikely that you get a garbage guitar out of Squire.
I think we only ended up spending like $280. It was still cheaper than getting a vintage modified, and that thing plays like American made Strat, and it was fun to build. I'm also that person who was like, given the choice between a guitar that I'm allowed to mod,
right,
or a guitar that is like super expensive, I'm going to go for the guitar that's mod. Because when it comes to it, it's expensive, it's like, it's, at that point, to me, it's like an art. It's like an art piece that, like, you just kind of want to look at. You don't really want to actually play, but you want to just say, hey, look at that in the corner there. That looks really pretty. So, and yeah. At the same time, I love playing modded guitars just because they're throwaway in a way, but they're also, like, they are characters. They are unique.
And you like playing them at, I feel like maybe you're almost a little uncomfortable playing the higher instruments.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
If it comes down to like, I'm already like, I don't like touching other people. I was playing your Les Paul Junior. I'm like, I don't want to touch this.
I was like, Sean, play it.
No, please don't.
Play that guitar. Do it.
You can't make me. But it comes down to is like any kind of high end, something like that is that idea of like, it is the elite. It is something that is, and essentially a meme of itself.
Okay.
And a lot of times I don't want to touch it because it's not a real guitar. It's this idea of like, you don't really want to drive a Ferrari every single day. You can if you want, but the value of it's different.
That's an interesting viewpoint. Like, yeah, if once you do have kind of the special thing, you can't help but get a little bit less special if it's something you do on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Yeah. That does make sense. Like, that the Ferrari analogy is probably pretty good. Like, if you asked me, because if you would ask me 10 years ago if I wanted to drive a Ferrari every day, I'd be like, absolutely.
Yeah.
And now it's like, no. That would get uncomfortable, and then you'd be worried about it, and then, like, somebody would key it, and you're like, oh, no, my Ferrari. And, like,
yeah.
Like
$20,000 later.
Yeah, not that I have the option to drive a Ferrari every day, but even if I did.
That wasn't
I,
your Ferrari out front?
No, that wasn't mine. No,
oh, that was the neighbor.
Oh, Slash is coming here.
Oh, that's right, that's right,
yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, I'm making him wait, though.
There you go.
I
feel so special.
He texted me. He was trying to come in early. I told him he has to sit out there and wait. So, anyway, let's see. What's some other stuff we should talk about? We talked a bunch. And we talked a bunch today. We should have just had lapel mics on.
Oh, there you go.
That would have been classy.
Talk about food.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna talk about food.
That's later, towards the end.
Yeah. We still got more ground to cover, but so I kind of made reference to it, and you talked about Tom Waits. But who are some of your artists you like or draw inspiration from?
So as a teen, I was really obsessed with. Like punk music. I loved Richard Hell and the Voidoids. And then I got into like the no wave scene, be like James Chance in the Contortionist,
mm-hmm.
and Contort Yourself. I loved that album. And then as I got older, my influences kind of shifted as like more and more I interacted with different people. And then I started getting like dating other girls who like had like they liked indie music. So then all of a sudden I went from obsessed with punk, and then okay, I liked indie music. I like we were talking about Modest Mouse, The Shins. Oh man, Grizzly Man, mm-hmm. 2 weeks was like one of my favorite. I put that on repeat forever. I love that. And then I got into the Bend culture of my era, which was we'll just say it was a lot of reggae.
Okay.
and got into that kind of community, and then I ended up loving kind of like I believe they call it technically it's ska, like original 60s ska.
Okay.
And I really love kind of that offbeat. And then I ended up meeting my wife, and she is all over the board with music, and she's one of those people who like I love, like she's amazing, and she's unapologetic about anything she does.
Mm-hmm.
And for the longest time, I like there's certain music that I wouldn't let in my car, like any kind of Taylor Swift. I couldn't. I nothing against Taylor Swift or anything, but it just I'd never enjoyed that. And it was more like okay, I started listening to more whatever she was listening to, so I ended up getting to you know that kind of poppy music, rap. I was never really into rap.
Mm-hmm.
I love that kind of style, and then ended up doing that, and then I kind of hit to that point where I just went back to the classics, and that's where I love Tom Waits. I still love a lot of my kind of like you know the Dead Kennedys, the Misfits, that kind of classic punk.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of I'm all over the board. It's hard to really define myself because if you were to find my Spotify list, it's like I had my one playlist which was I called Proto, and it used to be all my favorite proto punks, and then as time shifted, it's all of a sudden you have like Childish Gambino in there, and you have mm-hmm. Redbone and This Is America, or you have you know Snoop Dogg, Gin and Juice, or even all the way to Kanye West, Jesus Walks. Like it's all over the board, and it's not really defined, and it's kind of one of those ones where it's like helped me. One, it helps me appreciate because it's like it's really easy to be like, oh well, this one style of music sucks over the other, but it's still someone so passionate creating something, mm-hmm. and I guess that's where my life kind of taught me. It's like no, it's someone. It's no different than any music you listen to.
We are brought to you today by Sweetwater, specifically the Gear Exchange. You may have heard about this. This is a place where you can go to buy and sell your used gear. Maybe you got a pedal over there that's just kind of collecting dust. Maybe there's something you've been eyeing from the Sweetwater catalog. Well, right now is a great time to turn that unused gear into something you're actually going to use. Even better, if you sell on the Gear Exchange, you can keep 100% of the sale as long as you choose a Sweetwater gift card as your payout method. That is not too shabby, because let's be honest, most of this buying and selling we do is just to fund new gear purchases, and that is a great way to reach a wide variety of customers and keep 100% in your pocket, or rather, on your pedal board. So go check out the Sweetwater Gear Exchange and turn that unused gear into something that's actually going to help you write that next huge riff.
Hello there. I'd like to introduce you to your new best friend, the Chaseless Audio Lossy. Lossy is a collaboration between Chaseless and Good Hertz. It's meant to give you some control over those weird digital artifacts that come with very compressed audio. You're hearing it right now. All the changes that are taking place are strictly coming from my playing dynamics. I'm just interacting with the pedal and letting it do its thing. In some true stereo goodness. If you'd like some more details about Lossy, I invite you to head over to chaselessaudio.com. I think you're going to like what you find.
It's true. It's a lot easier to put our own, you know, sort of artists that we like up on a pedestal and be like, no, these are the good ones.
You're all wrong. And he's number one.
Yeah, like you don't know what you're talking about.
Tom,
I do it all the time, honestly, and I do it very publicly, especially with a lot of bro country stuff.
Yeah.
And I have a hard time buying that there's a lot of passion in the Friday Night Moonlight stuff. But, you know, somebody did have to spend time creating it, so I guess I can appreciate that. But I was very critical of things that I really had no business critiquing, you know, as a teenager. It's like, that band's terrible. That band's for girls. That band's XYZ. And it's like, what was I really talking about?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know what I was talking about. I had no...
I was trying to show off.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I feel like. I was trying to show off. I had no, like, experience to draw off of to decide whether somebody was good or not. Like, I just decided that they weren't screaming, so they weren't good.
Well, and I also found that, like, a lot of the bands I loved as a kid, like, really, like, I was obsessed with the Violent Femmes, and I still love the Violent Femmes, and even past, most people's experience with Violent Femmes is their first debut album, but they have a lot of phenomenal other albums past that. But sometimes when I listen to it, it's a little too angsty for my adult, because I'm like, man, I was so whiny.
Right.
Like, it's like, okay, as much as I love the music, I'm just like, I can't listen to it sometimes. It's still kind of
sometimes like get over it, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, come on.
I'm sorry you're having a bad day, but it was kind of your own fault.
Right, and you need to grow up and get over
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Like, do you need some ice cream?
Yeah, I do. I fortunately, like, most of the bands that I really, really loved as a teenager, I have held up for me for the most part. There's a few that I'm like, what was I listening to? Like, I don't know about that. But for the most part, I still really like, you know, any of the ones I was really passionate about. They've stuck with me for the most part. Thrice being the most notable example that I won't shut up about. I'll try to stop talking about them. But
that's
like,
right. I have those people.
But that was a big influence. And I'm still trying to figure out. And I talked about this on the episode with the Ryan from Fuzzrocious, but I'm trying to figure out why it took me like so many years to get a baritone. Like, that's one of my favorite bands, and I finally got a baritone. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Another one of my influences in music I absolutely love, mm-hmm. And when I play guitar, I actually play is like a Delta blues,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of those guitars that I'm like, I really should. If I always play in D, it's like that would probably sound really awesome.
Mm-hmm. And it's more comfortable.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, this guitar was made for this tuning instead of me forcing another guitar into...
Wait, you're not supposed to hear the strings hit the frets?
Well, that's what I'm told.
I don't know. I thought that was the sound.
Yeah, for years, that's how I did it.
Exactly.
Just tune it down. It'll be fine. You don't change string gauges. Just tune it on down and it'll be okay. But no, having that baritone is like, it really has changed. And I definitely play it way different than any of my other guitars. I'm just much more riffy with it than than my other stuff. I find that it's easier for me to write or play cool riffs on baritone than it is in standard. I don't know why.
That's another thing I've realized getting away from Gibson's guitars is how certain guitars want to make you want to play a certain way.
Yeah.
And more times, like the Jaguar, I end up trying to play a little more rockabilly or a little surf rock as much as I can, because I really can't, but I try. Mm-hmm. But it's just like the idea of like there's a certain sound that's associated with that, and it makes you want to play differently and other than your normal kind of style.
It really does. That Rickenbacker, I talked about it early on, and I haven't talked about it as much lately, but strangely, I don't play that guitar like most other people play Rickenbackers. Like, they think of them as jangle machines, and that's what I thought of them as initially. And I don't do anything but, like, heavy fuzz, like, very aggressive stuff on the Rickenbacker. I don't know why. It makes me play that way. Like, that's what I want to play when I plug it in. If I try to play the clean, jangly stuff, it's like, this isn't even the guitar that I like to do that on. Doesn't sound as good to me.
Just Beatles covers every time.
That's what I associated with it. That's what I really thought I was going to do. And I got out and I'm just like, bah, dah, 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 just doing all this, other stuff.
Oasis have a Rickenbacker?
I don't know. That's not a band paid any attention to.
I have, with Rickenbackers, I have two sensations. It's one is the Beatles guitar, even though it's like saying the Hofmeyr bass is just the Beatle bass. But it's also, I remember that being like a really big guitar for 90s kind of, what do you want to call that? Like surf alt.
Okay. I'm not quite following you. Like what kind of bands?
Now being on the spot, I'm like, oh, panic. I want to say like Oasis had one. I just also remember that just being like, you know, like just that 90s trying to be the 60s band.
Okay, gotcha.
Those style,
gotcha,
and they ended up playing that, and then you got some sweet tones out of that. And at least that one in the 12-string version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're a good time. And what's weird about it too is a lot of like Rickenbacker purists, they're like, oh, you got to get the one with the toasters in it. That's the one. And I've played them with the toasters, and I'm, you know, maybe this is, you know, treason, but I like the I like the high gains better. And I find it hilarious that they're called high gains because they're so low output, even compared to like toasters are extra low output. And I'm definitely not the guy chasing the hottest pickups. I tend to like pretty low output pickups, but those are like the toasters were too low for me. I like the high gains, and I know they don't sound quite the same, but they feel better to me.
And that's all that matters. Do you like it?
That's
you
true.
Like it. I that's do like all it. That matters.
I do like it quite a bit.
Screw the haters.
Got them haters. So we already ate pizza today. So, and we've talked about it briefly, but we are getting close to that point in the episode where we would discuss what your favorite kind of pizza is.
It's the one made of pizza. Any kind of pizza. I love anything that has cheese, sauce, and bread. Mm-hmm. I will eat, and I'll eat by the handful.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say all the pizzas to be safe.
Wow. Seems
I could
like
troll people. I still want to troll people, like, you know what the best pizza of all time is?
What?
It's pineapple.
No, it's not.
It's. Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Are you positive?
I'm positive. I have checked.
I love, again, I don't like pineapple pizza. For the record, I love pineapple, but don't put it on pizza. I don't know. I like a nice, really cheesy, kind of saucy, really good bread or dough pizza. Whether the toppings are, your pizza was actually really nice with the pepperoni and pepperoncinis.
Yes.
That was a good pizza. But I'm not picky when it comes to pizza. If it's pizza, I'm going to eat it. Well, if it's food, I'm going to eat it.
Yeah, I hear that. I'm picky with where I will choose to go get pizza. Like if I have the option to pick, like I'm going to pick certain places over other places. But if it's like, here's the Little Caesars, I'm like, okay, all right.
Little Caesars is good. It's $5. You're going to regret it tomorrow, but you're going
to
love it.
Yeah. It's you can't compare it to some sort of like, you know, legit Italian wood-fired thing or a real like New York slice or whatever, but it's not like you put it in your mouth and like, ew, this cheese and bread and sauce is sure terrible. It's like, those taste pretty good.
It's fine. It's pizza.
It's pizza. That said, used to get this pizza from this place in Portland because it was the only place that would deliver to my work.
Oh, God.
And so they would get it occasionally. And I got to be honest, like, that's like the only pizza I've turned down. I've got it before, and then sometimes I would just take it and I just slide all the toppings off and then just throw the crust in the garbage because it was terrible. Like, I've had better frozen pizzas. It was bizarre.
I guess I've had one pizza, and I'm kind of shameful of this, that had, like, it was a giant pizza. Mm-hmm. And we bought it for work, and everyone's supposed to eat it. But it had, like, the soapy taste to it.
That's kind of what this had going
on. Yeah, right?
On.
And
yeah.
I'm like, okay, was it the pot itself? And no one's going to eat it. And so I ate it myself. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't enjoying it. But you're not going to just leave pizza out to not be eaten. I think I did take it home.
I this pizza that I'm talking about, and I'm not going to be slamming it, the local business. That you, everyone
support local, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. They can find out for themselves. But it was pizza that I would have left on the table. And that's saying something for me. Like, it was, like, dry and, like, I'm like, this crust is just, something's wrong with the crust. It was, like, powdery and weird.
Do you ever dip it in ranch?
No.
See, that's where, like, if it's a really bad pizza, like, my wife loves the frozen pizzas. Like, it's one of those guilty pleasures. She's like, she knows for a fact that it's, like, don't judge her for it. She's like, I know, I'm embarrassed myself, but she loves it from her own, I think,
like,
from being
like
in college.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. I think it was from being in college, and mm-hmm. it was either ramen or cheap pizzas.
Right.
So whenever she buys those, I'm like, okay, do we have ranch? Because I think that's the only way I can actually eat those pizzas without, like, kind of like gagging a little bit. So I will dip that. I will have pizza with my ranch.
Yeah. I think I would just have to pass altogether. I'm not a big ranch dressing fan. So it would, like, make it worse, I think, for me.
Potentially. But I just don't waste food.
Yeah, that's right. I'm big on that. I do not like to see food go to waste, even if I'm not a big fan of it. But at the same time,
that or put hot sauce too. So, like, I can't taste it in the end.
There you go. That's a good solution. I could hose something down with some Franks or something.
Exactly.
And call it, that can rescue just about anything, except maybe ice cream.
Maybe. I don't know. Let's try this. Funny story. So we're trying to. I had a dog who she liked to get up on our counter,
mm-hmm.
and we ended up reading, hopefully this doesn't offend people, reading that a good way to get your dog to not get up on the counter and eat food is put hot sauce on something that she will smell it and be like, okay, you don't want to get it.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up getting, okay, I had Frank hot sauce. I love buffalo wings. Like, I will eat those every day of my life. Especially when I'm sick, I will always want buffalo wings. Mm-hmm. So we ended up trying Frank's hot sauce, and then my dog was like, no, I like that. So so she ends up eating the hot sauce, and then we get even spicier hot sauce, which was like a I can't remember what it is, and she was like, again, loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ended up getting this thing called, it was like devil sauce. And at this point, like, we're like, okay, we can't, this idea is dumb.
Like, this isn't working.
She obviously likes hot sauce, and she ends up, we get this, like, super hot stuff, and that was the only time she didn't. So I have this giant jar of, like, super, super hot hot sauce, and usually that's reserved for when I can't eat something, but I know I need to eat it because it's food.
Right. It's food, and we should consume it.
Exactly. So. Good in burritos.
What's that?
It's good in burritos.
Oh, okay.
Burritables.
The guy that, another quick plug for Fear the Riff, but which I'm, by
coming
this time
soon.
This drops, I'll probably be in the air or almost by the time this comes out. So weird timing. But the guy that runs Through the Rift, Johnny, he owns a hot sauce company.
Oh, there you go.
And he's got one called Riff Lord that I am, like, addicted to. It's so good on anything that hot sauce would be good on. This is just even better. It's super, super good. So his company's called Heartbreaking Dawns for anybody. And they didn't sponsor this episode, but well, really, really, really good hot sauce. Heartbreaking Dawns. I like it. Even though they got one called the 1498, and it's the scorpion pepper one.
Ooh.
And I, you know, I can only take so much heat. But that one's so good. Like, I have to, like, hit myself with it once in a while. Just like, let me hit me a little bit of that on some eggs. And I eat it. And I'm like, this is so delicious. It's going to hurt in just a second. Oh, there it is. Ah!
I have a bad habit. Like, I love spicy food. Mm-hmm. And I have a bad habit of, like, it's really hot. And I'll eat it. And, like, my wife is, like, next to me. She's like, oh, my God, it's burning my eyes. It's so hot. I'm like, oh, it's fine. So I'll eat it, and I'll eat it, and I'll eat a lot. And all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, God, I'm dying.
There it is.
Well, there, it finally hits me to the point where I'm, like, I start, like, hiccuping. That happened to, we were at a Chinese restaurant. And I can't remember what I got, but it had like the full chilies. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it was in the spoonful. I was like, I'll just eat it. It's fine.
Yeah.
And it was fine for a couple seconds. And then it really hit me. And then my eyes started watering and it looked like I was crying and we were getting in a fight at some restaurant. But my wife's like, I swear I didn't say anything.
The hot stuff is weird. I haven't done that much research into it, but I like spicy food. But what I find really weird about certain hot things, it's like, you have to keep eating it.
Yes.
And it's when you stop that the fire really hits you. So it's like, oh, this is going to be so bad when this bowl's empty. Like, it's kind of hot right now, but I know if I stop, like, it's like the wall of fire just comes in. I don't know what that's about.
It's killing your taste buds.
Is that what it is?
It's most likely. It's like your taste buds are getting sensory overload. And then by the time they realize what's happening, you're like, okay, they're gone.
It's just too late.
It's too late.
Oh, man. That is a...
And then your stomach's like, what did you just do to me?
Usually, so that's what's interesting is like, usually if I can get it past like the hot mouth and everything, I'm okay. I seem to be able to digest it okay. But sometimes it's going, you know, trying to eat it. And
that's the battle.
It's really, I love spicy food, but I have a hard time. It varies so much. It's like this local Thai place. You know, my buddy was like, careful, and they start with a 3. It's pretty hot. And so I started with a 3. I'm like, this ain't hot. Like, and I went to the 4, and the 5 was their hottest. 5 didn't seem that hot to me, and I'm not a tough guy. So my point is it varies. And then I've had stuff. We have a place that's been on, like, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives a lot around here called, Salvador Molly's. Have you been there?
Yeah.
So I got that. I can't remember what level I got for my jambalaya. I got like a mid-level one. And it was pretty hot. And then all of a sudden, it killed me. I couldn't eat anymore. But there was quite a bit left. I was like, I'll take it home. Maybe I'll dilute it with some eggs or something.
Put some milk in it.
Yeah. Like, we'll be okay. But like, I was like, I had to tap out. I couldn't eat it. It was too hot. Next day, threw it in the bowl. Warmed it up, and I was like, I'll take a couple bites and see what I need to do. Ate the whole thing. No problem.
Really?
And I didn't even... It was like, it's kind of hot. I don't know. I feel like it changes on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I mean, that's true. And I don't know if this is the general thing. I used to work for a liquor store, and there was a product done by a local company, which was wasabi vodka.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, get this. So
that sounds a little bit not like something for me.
It's dangerous. It's complete, like, mainly for Bloody Marys. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, it sold somewhat well. It had his things. But then all of a sudden, we got this mass sent out email being like, please take this off the shelf. This is dangerous. Please don't do it.
What?
Because what happened was, and they didn't think about this, is they made it so spicy that the more you open up the bottle, the spicier it got. So by the time people were getting towards like the end of the bottle, it was like, it was undrinkable and like, it was dangerous to even touch it because it was just like burn your hands.
Really?
It was funny. Yeah. That was like the only time I've ever gotten a product recall. I was like, I kind of want to try this.
Right.
Can I take one home?
Does that liquor get recalled that often?
No, very rarely. I worked 8 years in the liquor industry and I probably had it happen like 3 times.
Oh.
The what happens, there's 3 things that happen. One, like a bad recipe like that. But a lot of times is you'll have stuff from like a filter situation. Like tequilas, a lot of tequilas will end up having like the what they filter it through is like this like blue kind of foamy stuff. And it will like deteriorate and it'll go into the bottle. And then actually most of them tend to be tequilas. Not bashing tequilas. Tequilas are fun.
Just coincidentally.
Just coincidentally. Mm-hmm. And then you also had another big one. And this was like big news. This giant liquor company that has numbers on it. I don't want to say it just in case they're listening because they're following us. They ended up having, they were known for you can put, you can tip the tequila upside down and it would pour the perfect shot. And then the lid had like this,
Oh, that sounds familiar.
You've probably seen it because there was a ton of commercials for it. And it had the guy from The Sopranos. He was like
he was on there. Yeah, okay.
But what happened is they got a bad batch of glass. So the glass just started to deteriorate.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So all of a sudden you got this really bad recall notice that you're like, okay, take this off the shelf, sending it back to the manufacturer because mm-hmm. You'd look at it and there's just kind of this white
glass kind of stuff.
And that was probably the worst. But for the most part, it's usually kind of manufacturer error. And it comes down to making it hot or the label's wrong. Because there's a lot of rules that liquor companies have to follow, especially with like the Surgeon General's notice on it. If it doesn't have like a label screwed up on that, they can't sell it. They legally have to like take it off the shelf. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times you associate with that, but there's not very, liquor is like that one thing. It's like very safe in the sense of there's not much you can do to screw it up.
Right. As long as you,
you can screw yourself up,
right?
But you can't screw it up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny that even this day and age, like I understand why it would have come into play when it came into play, but like, that you were just talking about the Surgeon General's label being a big deal. It's like, it's kind of funny that this day and age is like, yeah, people need to know. Like, that, if you drink too much of that, it's not good for you.
Like, anything in moderation. I mean, it's true. And I mean, that being said, it's like you would think that, but I've also been in the side of the liquor store. I have like those horror stories. You're just like, how are you a human being?
Right.
It's just like that bizarre. It's weird.
I just don't think the label's going to stop that guy.
No, it's not going to stop. No, there's not much stopping that guy.
No.
Clearly. Including myself.
You're like, here you go, buddy.
Yeah.
Good times.
Yeah.
Well, we finally, we've hit that hour mark just to touch over. But is there anything else you'd like to plug before we wrap this up?
Support Blake. Support the community. Gun Street is really focused. It sounds really funny to say, but I really don't care about the money. I really care about the community and what you do in the community and how it can help other people. Growing up, the community is one of the biggest things about myself. So anything you can do to support the community, whether listening to Blake or just, you know, talking with other people about guitars, just help out. Follow Gun Street on Instagram, Facebook. Don't follow us on Instagram. Your choice.
No, I said follow him.
Follow him. There you go.
Do it. No, that's what's great about Sean and why we talked, and I was excited to have him on the show. Even you know he, as you guys have heard, he sponsored the show quite a bit, but he's very focused on the guitar community and how it's helped him in his life, and he wants to give back, and I really appreciate that, and appreciate you taking the time to come down, and it was great talking to you.
Thanks so much. Yeah.
So, for Sean, this is Blake, and as always, folks, good luck and good tones.
I gotta say, I'm kind of digging this more live in-studio approach to this this stuff. As a lot of you guys know, 99.9% of these are done remote, and A, they don't sound quite as good, and B, it's just kind of the nature. No one can drop what they're doing and fly to Portland for a session, nor can I travel the country to talk to, or the world in some cases, to talk to these people. So remote podcasting is the name of the game most of the time. That said, I'm really liking this live in studio stuff. It's a little more personal. It's a little more, it's a little weird because I'm not used to having a big mic in my face quite in the same way while I'm trying to look at someone and have a conversation. But that said, this is working out pretty well, I think. And we're going to try to do more of it. There's a lot of people local to me that are in the industry. And, you know, hopefully maybe when people happen to pop in from out of town, we can take some time, do a little casting and catch up at the same time. So hopefully we're going to bring more live from the shred shed type things for you guys. That said, there is about another 30 minutes or so of this podcast that we went ahead and recorded. We recorded an extra kind of bonus content sort of episode for the Patreon page. So if you go to tonemob.com/no, I'm always saying tonemob.com, but in this case, that's wrong. Patreon.com/tonemob is actually the place. That's patreon.com/tonemob. And you can see the different levels there. You know, you can support the show for as little as $1 a month, and that actually helps a lot more than what you would think. At the $5 level, you start getting extra bonus weekly episodes. And there's some other levels there that you can research if you're interested, but at $5 a month, you get a bonus episode every week, so more content for your ears. Usually it's my good friend Justin Porter and I just shooting the breeze in the shred shed talking about gear. He's a very active member of the community and one of my best friends, so you can imagine the vibe's a little bit different. But that said, sometimes I get the guests for extra time, and I'm going to try to push as much of that as we can, but it's all kind of up to whether the guests have the time to do it or not. So anyway, that's where you go for that information. And if you could do me a favor and share this show with just one friend, somebody you think might get something out of it, just tell them about it. Sharing online is great, and that's how most people find it, but there's a kind of a personal touch that comes from like a recommendation. Like, I mean, that's how I got into podcasting, was by Leon being like, you need to listen to these guitar podcasts. So it's sometimes takes that good personal connection to get people to pull the trigger, and that really, really helps out around here if you can make that happen. And one last thing to plug before the show is officially over. This is the last episode that will be coming out before I am attending Fear the Riff. So I'm flying out in a couple days to New York City. I'll be there August 11th, Saturday, August 11th. That is just here in a couple days as of this episode's dropped. And I hope to see you guys there. I'm going to have some swag for people. If you are a listener of the show, you know that you need to contact me, info@tonemob.com, and I might be able to do a little something as far as getting you into the show goes. So that's Fear the Riff, Brooklyn, New York, and I really hope to see you there. It's gonna be great, and I'm really excited to meet everybody and to play a whole bunch of new pedals, because who isn't excited about that? So anyway, thank you guys for listening. We'll be coming at you next week, and until then, take care. One last thing before we totally sign off here, I just want to remind you that if you do any shopping at Stringjoy, that's Stringjoy Guitar Strings made in Nashville, that will help me out as well. As I've said for years, I'm heavily involved in that company, and I really do think they're making the best products on the market. So if you would like to try custom strings, go to tonemob.com/stringjoy and check them out today. I seriously, seriously, seriously love what the team down there is doing. I help them out with all kinds of things, and by you supporting them, you are also supporting me as well. And hey, you need some strings, so why not get some custom strings just for your guitar and playing style? Again, the link for that is tonemob.com/stringjoy, and that will take you right to their website, and you can do all your shopping through there, and that will help everyone involved out. So thank you very much. Talk to you next time. We are brought to you by the wonderful folks at Gun Street Wiring Shop. Yes, Gun Street Wiring Shop. I've talked about them before. I used to say based out of Bend, Oregon, but guess what? Sean moved to my neck of the woods. Sean's in Portland. Sean is awesome and has helped me with a bunch of stuff lately. And if you have wiring needs for your guitar, he can help you too. If you want to get weird with it, he can get weird. If you just need to spruce things up a little bit, there's your guy. He takes all the guesswork out of doing your guitar wiring, and he makes it simple, and his customer service is top-notch, and I can't say enough good things about Gun Street as a company. I really respect Sean and what he's all about, and the product is top-notch. I've got 3 different guitars that now have Gun Street harnesses in them, and I could not be happier. So go to gunstreetwiringshop.com and check them out.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freites from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.